Concession number 21552, wheel 4.
Raymond Venables, Reel 4. So you joined HMS Edinburgh sometime in the summer of 1941.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first patrol that you were involved in?
We were up in Scapa, and we were going mostly up in the Arctic. We were on patrol. I remember spending my 21st birthday with the middle watch on patrol between Iceland and Greenland. We were up by Spitsbergen. That was the first sort of things we did.
What type of things were you doing on the patrol? Were you looking for anything in particular?
We were looking for that time there were German raiders, I suppose Scharnhorst and Eisenhower, who were thought to be coming out and going into the South Atlantic, and some of them did. We were supposed to sight them in the Denmark Strait, I think it's called, up there between Iceland and Greenland. So we went backwards and forwards, avoiding the icebergs, but we never saw anything on up there.
What were the conditions like? Was that during the summer period?
No, it wasn't by then. By the time we got up there, it was extremely cold anyway. It was also oddly daylight all the time, at some point. I've got somewhere a copy of Boswell's Life of Johnson, which I had with me, and I've written it, pencil is fading, but it's a sort of line shoot. It says, read this book by daylight at 12 o'clock at night. Very odd.
Did that take much adjusting to the hour? Hmm? Did it take much adjusting to the 24 hours almost? With
well, that? I mean, as soon, when you're young, as soon as you do it, you just do it. I nearly always woke up, but just before, with the watches, I usually woke up just before the chap came to wake me up.
And what length would these patrols be? How long would you be out from Scapa Flow for?
I don't know, 2 weeks perhaps. I can't really remember that, but it didn't make much difference because being anchored in Scapa wasn't very different from anything else.
Would you patrol with other vessels, or would you be on your own?
We were sometimes on our own, sometimes with others, sometimes with a couple of... I remember being with a couple of town-class cruisers, Sheffield and Manchester, perhaps, sometimes.
And were there any incidents that occurred at all?
Not much up there, no. Until, finally, when I left the ship, she was actually sunk on an Arctic convoy going to Murmansk. And if you remember, they found some gold on board her later, and there's a great thing about that. But that was after I'd left her.
So you did these patrols and returned to Scapa.
Mm-hmm.
Did that take from the summer period up into...?
We're well into the winter by then. I'm not actually sure the date I joined her. Might have been a bit later, because we then went... we then started going off the Bay of Biscay, and we did patrols there. Again, we were looking for raiders, and we did find one, which saw us and scuttled itself before we could do anything. We had the prisoners on board. That was a big, fast merchant ship was trying to sort of run the blockade from South America.
Can you describe to me what you saw of the action?
Well, we went to action stations, and there was this ship, and the captain did not do what his gunnery officer wanted to do and shoot over its bows or anything. So the thing sank, and they got in their boats and came on board, and we locked the prisoners up in suitable places, and I was one of the guards.
So what were the prisoners like?
They were quite, as usual, they were quite relieved, not to be down on the bottom of the sea.
And you spoke German, did you speak to
them? Yes, I did, I spoke to them. And it was odd. It was more marked later when I talked to prisoners, but you could ask them about Hitler, and they, the Navy was not very pro-Hitler. The Navy was mostly, the proper Navy was, you know, pre-Hitler, and they were not in favour particularly, or said they weren't. For the most part, like most prisoners, they're usually relieved to be alive. But I had a closer look at prisoners later when we sank a U-boat.
When you took these prisoners on board the Edinburgh and you were talking to them, what impression did you get of their thoughts of what the outcome of the war might be? Did you discuss that?
I think at that time we didn't actually discuss it, but it was looking good for them in those days, and they weren't beginning to wonder how it was going to turn out. I don't think. I mean, I think one of the things I did with them was sang some of their German folk songs. And I don't think with that lot, when I was a seaman, I did discuss very much with them. But anyway, it didn't last long because I got ticked off by the master at arms.
What happened there?
Well, I stopped talking to them and just looked at the master at arms, think I didn't like him very much.
Were you armed while you were dealing with them?
I think I did wear a pistol, yes.
So what happened with them? How were they treated generally? Not by yourself, but by
other perfectly guys? Well. I mean, the fact is that if you capture prisoners at sea, and it happened on other occasions, if you do talk to them, in no time at all, you almost feel more in common with them than you do with the civilians back home. After all, you're all on this bloody ocean. You're all living. You've got a lot in common, except the U-boat. People were under it, even. And I've a remarkable feeling of fellowship with them. You don't blame them for being in a different uniform and fighting on the other side at all.
Can you remember the name of the ship that you sank?
No, not that one. No.
What did you? Were the prisoners then incarcerated on board the ship?
Yes.
Where would that be?
Somewhere down below. I can't really remember.
And what was their eventual fate?
Well, we landed them, and then they go to a prison camp. Again, with some later ones where I knew more, but I didn't know much about them.
So, when you took this raider, what was the feeling aboard the ship?
What was?
The feeling on board the ship.
Well, as I say, there was a powerful feeling that the captain ought to have been more proactive and shot a few rounds, and we might have pinched the ship and taken it home as a prize.
And but what would you have got for prize money?
I don't know, because you know, the last of the prize money was paid in the war, but it was paid at the end of the war. And it was divided about among everybody, and I got a few quid, but it was the whole thing levelled off.
So are there any other incidents that occurred while you were patrolling in Biscay? Did you see any German aircraft? Or?
Yes, we did, and this is while we're off the Bay of Biscay. We used to see those German Fokker Wolfs, which are very long distance, and they tended to come and plot all the shipping, and they'd go around in a great circle well out of and just plot where you were. Later on we used to see them, we sometimes used to flash messages to them.
Did they return a message?
Yes, quite often.
Did you have any problems with U-boats?
Not in the Edinburgh. We did later when we not U-boats so much. We had trouble with most things when we got to the Mediterranean.
So how long were you patrolling the Bay of Biscay for?
Oh, 2 weeks.
Would that still be in 1941?
Yes.
So how did the patrolling come to an end in the Bay of Biscay? Did you return to the UK or?
No, we went on. We then went to. Oh well. What did happen, it was quite important. We were there when the Bismarck was out. And The way it appealed to me as an ordinary seaman, we were going south towards Gibraltar, I suppose, at a sort of lazy 12 knots or something, and suddenly the ship turned round and started steaming north into quite a heavy sea at about 28 knots with the spray going over the mast, and then the captain came on and told us the Bismarck was out, and we were going to, it was thought to be heading for Brest, and we were going to be between it and Brest. And I think apart from the ships that sank it, we were the closest ship to her that night, and it's just as well we didn't meet, otherwise I might not be talking to you now. But what happened, in fact, is that they flew off some swordfish and they rather improbably hit it. They came back and said they hadn't hit it, and they had, in fact, put its steering gear out. So it was going off in circles a long way west of Brest, and we were between it and Brest going up and down, but it never reached us because its steering, and it was done in and out of sight of us. So we never, in fact, had anything to do with it.
What was the crew's feelings when they heard that the Bismarck had been sunk?
Well, the funny thing was that when something really was up, you did feel the adrenaline flowed, and you felt a zest. The point you almost, just temporarily, didn't last really. You wanted to go into battle. I remember once they put one of Churchill's speeches, the one about... we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them in the landing. And they put this on the gun deck, coming down the gun decks, going into a head sea, and, you know, you really felt as if you could swim ashore and take Hitler personally by the scruff of the neck. It wasn't a feeling that you had very often, but just occasionally, yes.
On the opposite side, what about the sinking of the Hood? What was the opinion when you...
It was horrifying. Absolutely horrifying, because when I was waiting for the Edinburgh, we were 1 week in a depot ship, which had to be seen to be believed, and the food was so awful that I volunteered for a galley party, so I thought I might eat, and so did one other chap. He was called Spike Haddo, and we sat talking. He was an extraordinarily nice bloke, and we sat talking about everything under the sun, peeling mountains of potatoes. And then he left for the Hood, and I left for the Edinburgh. And the last thing I said to him, "Oh, Hood, great big battle wagon, you'll be safer in that than walking down Piccadilly Circus." And he turned out to be... to have been an old Arovian, and I taught at Harrow after the war. And when I went to have a cup of coffee in the break, I used to go up to the War Memorial, and there among all these officers was ordinary Seaman Haddo, and I tipped my hat to him before I went and drank my coffee. A good man, good chap, and a great loss.
Are things like that generally felt throughout the whole of the Navy?
About
the sinking of a major capital.
Oh, yes, it was a horror. The Prince of Wales later and so on. Yes, it really did shake people, just as it shook the country and the government, I think.
You'd been patrolling in the Bay of Biscay and you were moving down to Gibraltar. Mm. What happened when you arrived at Gibraltar?
Well, we joined Force H to do a run through to the one of those convoys to Malta.
Did you get leave in, shore leave in Malta?
Yes.
In Gibraltar?
Yes.
What were your impressions of Gibraltar?
Extraordinary. Extraordinary place, because it was absolutely full of male servicemen. One of the things one remembers is how few women there were in the services and how desperately spoiled they were. I remember seeing a girl walking down the beach, I forget the name of it, we all went to the beach, and she was, in the sense, she was flanked by sort of three on each side, colonels and above. She was a simple soul, just a pretty girl, but they were very short. It was extraordinary atmosphere that way in Gibraltar.
What would you do while you were ashore?
Well, I used to go ashore with friends. You would go sometimes there. The wrens were great because you could go and they would ask you to go and dance, and you would go and dance, and you know, you weren't expected to sort of go to bed with them or anything. It was all very respectable and nice and friendly, and it was nice to go and talk to nice women. I remember going to a party there, and lots of wrens there, and lots of officers from the shore. And what struck me was that I was engaged, but some of my brother officers might like to have seen what the local talent was, but you couldn't get a look in because all the shore chaps, you know, there's something in women which likes to have a chap not who's going to leave the day after tomorrow, but who's going to be there sitting at that desk the whole time. And what's more, because they spent most of their time on the beach, they were all bronzed. We were all white, you know, because we didn't sunbathe at sea. It was a very odd surprise to me that, because the seafarers do tend to look at the chair-born chaps, you know, with a certain... But you don't find everyone takes that point of view.
And what were conditions like on Gibraltar? Was the rationing, or...?
I can't remember that, because, of course, we lived on board. I remember one slightly improper story about a pal of mine who was RN, not like me, a sort of temporary officer and a temporary gentleman. He was a permanent gentleman. And he was called Tony Moore. And he said, I say, why should I went ashore? And I went to a dance. And I said, gosh, exciting, Tony. Was it fun? He said, well, it was a bit disturbing, really. I was dancing with a girl, and you wouldn't believe it, one of her breasts fell out. I said, my dear chap, what did you do? Well, he said, I put it back. I wasn't quite so, as I say, I was hooked. So if I went ashore, I tended to go ashore with male friends and have a drink or two and come back in.
Were the bars still functioning?
Yeah, yes, you could go into bars. My memory of Gib in particular is of the kind of, it was very beautiful, and the, you know, sad sort of Italian sounding songs coming out of people's open windows. I'd quite like to go back one day and have a look at it.
You mentioned there's a large military presence. What was the harbour like?
It was extraordinary. It was packed with very big ships, and not being of a particularly military cast of mind, I have to say that one of the things that sticks in the mind and almost made me feel military when it happened was when the fleet is in and it sounds off evening quarters, and to this day sort of it sort of does things down my spine, which a lot of things don't. I mean, people going off about the changing of the guard and people marching, as I said before, you know, that doesn't move me. Bugles do.
Did you have any particular friends while you were on the Edinburgh when you were in Gibraltar? Anybody you went ashore with?
Yes, there was one. Because we were together. Then we were together at the officers' training place. And we were friends of a sort, but we were very different. He was... yes, and I enjoyed talking to him. He, like me, became a schoolmaster. And... So I used to meet his colleagues, and he was, yes, we talked a lot, but we were very different.
What was he called?
He's called Charles Whittle. And I think he was a midshipman. He was a bit younger than I was, so he didn't... When we got promoted, he started, I think. But he's a very good cricketer and good rugby player, so we played a few games together when we were in training.
So you were just about to go on, involved in a convoy to Malta.
Yeah.
Can you explain the size of the convoy and what preparations?
Well, it was, I think it was, because I did two, but I think the first one was, I think Mussolini had said that no British ship would ever reach Malta again. So it was a very heavily armed convoy. We had the Rodney and the Nelson, Ark Royal, about 6 or 7 cruisers and about 17 destroyers. It was a big fleet. And it was impressive. And at times like that, having blown your bugles and setting off, and the day before you went, I was found, the night before was the night when you experienced common or garden fear. It's before it happens. And then when you first sail, we're on the move. And then when the bangs start, there's no doubt that something happens to you, adrenaline flows. Of course you're scared, but not in the same way.
So you sail from Malta. How many days was it before you experienced the first attacks?
Not long before you were first attacked. I should have thought you were, I can't really remember, but I should have thought you were a day. And then it all started around, they had an e-boat pen in Pantelleria, and they attacked with e-boats, and they attacked with high-level and low-level torpedo bombers before that. And then the fleet came out, but thought better. The Italian fleet thought better of it, went away again.
With the Italian attacks, how did the low-level torpedo bombers attack the ships?
Well, that you could see. I mean, you could see the others, but so there was one I had a very good view of, because they came skimming over the sea, and it looked to me as if there was a merchant ship there, but it looked to me, I don't want him, I want that cruiser. So he came round us, came at us, and I saw the torpedo drop out of its belly. But by then, the captain also noticed this, so what you did, as soon as you saw that, you said, full ahead, hard to starboard, and you turned the ship so that the thing just missed your stern like that. I can tell you, talking of our valiant sailors, that I had read somewhere that if you got torpedoed, you could sometimes, if you were standing too rigidly, the shock could come up and could kill you, and especially if you had your mouth shut. So I swear to you that as this thing approached, one brave sailor might have been seen with his knees slightly bent and his mouth open. We also had a lot of soldiers on board were taking to the garrison, and heaped ammunition, their ammunition. And they had their Bren guns and were helping us with the anti-aircraft fire. But what was funny is, okay, we were a bit worried about what might happen, but soldiers nearly panicked. One was in a huge state of fear. And I said, look, he said, I wouldn't mind if I could get my head down. That's a soldier's instinct, but you can't get your head down. And I said, yes, but, you know, in a ship, they've got to hit you. I mean, look at that. And there was a great shower of water went up as a bomb went a few feet away. You've got to hit you here, mate. You know, it's not so bad. It was very odd. It was a different... It just... You saw the difference in the whole of your training. You were trained to be wary of some things in one field, and in another it was quite different. And a very brave soldier was scared out of his wits because he wasn't in his element. He was in a ship.
And did the Italian air crews press these Holmes attacks quite vigorously?
Yes, they did, yes. We shot one down, and we picked up the pilot, and again, because it must have appeared somewhere on my papers that I spoke foreign languages, so I was yanked up by the commander and told him to go and interrogate this pilot. I said, but I don't speak a word of Italian, sir. Oh, come on, you can manage something. And I went and talked to this chap as best I could, but all I'd get out of him was a picture of his girlfriend in Naples. And when he produced this, I produced my one word of Italian. I said, bellissima! That was the end. I wasn't very much used to them in this case.
What about the high-level attacks? What form did they take?
Well, they just came over in formation and let go and hoped, and they missed, usually.
Were you more wary of the torpedo attacks or the...
Well, the more torpedo attacks were a bit more worrying, yes. Yes, I mean, those, you couldn't do anything about it. You shot at them, but they were pretty high.
How high would you...
I don't know. I wouldn't know, but, you know, there were little dots in the sky. They were...
So these initial attacks took place. You mentioned an E-boat attack. Did that happen after the initial torpedo and air attacks, or was that...
The E-boat, yes. They were at night. And I was on one side of the ship, and it so happened the E-boats came in the other side, and suddenly the other side is quite dark, and the other side of the ship erupted, and a great flash of everything, and every gun on that side of the ship hit a few U-boats and simply blew them out of the water. I didn't see it, but I asked a chap, a sailor, what it was like. He said, mate, it was like a mirage. One minute they were there, and the next minute they weren't.
So were these... How regular were the attacks, all the types of attacks?
Well, the air attacks were in daylight, and the E-boats at night came from their base in Pantelleria. I think it was the next day when the fleet came out, but the Rodney and the Nelson proceeded in their direction and they disappeared. And there were sort of sporadic things, but that's all I remember. Then we arrived in Valletta.
Had the ship had any damage at all during any of these attacks?
No, I think we got one bit of flying metal, but nothing. No, we didn't. Other ships did. One ship, we had a friend of mine, as it happened, I only learned afterwards, he got sunk in, I think she was called the Fearless, a destroyer. But he floated about a bit and got rescued, and then went to another ship and got sunk again and again got rescued.
It's interesting what you said about the Italian air crew. Were they... Would you say that they were aiming for the naval ships rather than...
I don't think in general, no. But I just, it occurred to me with this one. I mean, it's probably an illusion, but I thought, because I was in this one, that Italian has skidded round the stern of that one and is heading for me personally. It could have been... I don't think, if they had any sense, I mean, the object was to stop the merchant ships getting there. And on the whole, I should have thought they would not have attacked the naval ships. So they did, as I say, they sank the Fearless, so they were certainly... They damaged the Manchester, and they hit, in one of these convoys, they hit the Rodney. But all the Rodney did was lower its bows a couple of feet and carry on regardless.
And with the attacks occurring, was there a value in the previous training that you'd had in action, did you feel?
All the training, yes. I mean, not only all the training, but you grow up as a little boy thinking one day there might be a war on. Your chief worry is always that you won't be able to take it. I think most males that I know have this. You like to think you don't think you'll be a hero, but you like to think that you won't be any worse than anybody else. And And this is a sort of training. I think that you grow up, if you're a little English boy, you think of the next.